And now, a man who campaigned against Barack Obama in all 57 states, Mark Gillar.
Welcome to the Tea Party Power Hour. We have a great show lined up for you today. A little later on, we're going to have Eric Rush, the author of Negrophilia, on. But first, Brenda J. Elliott. She's an award-winning historian, researcher, and New York Times bestselling author. She is the blogger who created Resco Watch, The Real Barack Obama, and RBO2. She has appeared on hundreds of radio shows, now including this one, contributed to numerous investigative articles and publications, and is the co-author, along with Aaron Klein, of The Manchurian President, Red Army, and the book she's here to talk to us about today, Fool Me Twice, Obama's Shocking Plans for the Next 4 Years Exposed. Brenda, it is an honor to have you on the show today. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Well, one of the things I'd like to do before we dive into some of these predictions about what Obama might do in the next 4 years is just have you tell my listeners why you think these things might happen. I mean, when we pull back the curtain, who's really controlling the wizard? What are these groups that are feeding policy ideas to Barack Obama? Who are these groups, and what is their agenda?
Red Army, which Aaron and I wrote and came out the end of October, we went and looked at the groups, the progressive groups and think tanks that were behind the legislation that came out during Obama's first term in office, and namely Obamacare, the stimulus bill, the green programs that were part of that stimulus bill. Mm-hmm. And we really wanted to find out who they were, what their history was, and what they were all about. There are prominent think tanks, Center for American Progress, Economic Policy Institute, Institute for Policy Studies, another organization known as DEMOS, D-E-M-O-S, and a few others, depending on what the topic is, whether you're talking about the economy or you're talking about immigration. But for the most part, what we found when we did Red Army was we have basically the same cast of characters that show up as on boards of directors for these organizations, as well as advisory boards, and they kind of move around or they cross over. Different people serve in one capacity in one organization and then move on to serve in another capacity in another. And then, lo and behold, we discovered that a lot of them ended up in the Obama administration.
Imagine that.
So when we looked at all of these, and we did look at thousands of documents, including legislation for both books, we could see very clearly from looking at the past and how we got to the Obama legislation, we could see there were many more documents out there that looked like they were likely possibilities for future programs should there be a second administration. So we finished Red Army, we finished our media tour like the one we're doing now, and dug in to do Fool Me Twice to give people an idea of what could be coming ahead. We don't say by any means, by 100%, all of these things are likely to happen. But if there is an Obama second term, the possibility is very strong that many of these things will happen. And, in fact, between the time that we finished writing our manuscript around June 1st and hurried it off to the printers, a lot of things that we were talking about in the book already have begun to happen because, of course, Obama does not know for a fact he will be reelected. The progressives do not know for a fact they'll get another chance at a lot of these plans. So they're fast-tracking as many things as they can. And because they are stuck with a Republican-controlled House where appropriations for projects come from, Obama is using his presidential powers to do an end run. And again, Center for American Progress, after the midterm election, when the Democrats could no longer control the House, The Center for American Progress came out with a 54-page document. You can find it online. It's called The Power of the President. It came out in November 2010 in great detail explaining how Obama could use his executive powers to bypass Congress and the American public. Executive orders, presidential letters, presidential directives, rulemaking, which just means lots more regulations, management of the agencies at his disposal, like the EPA, for example, that has its nose stuck in immigration to protect species at the border, public-private partnerships, which are nothing more than more crony capitalism, using the military, which we have a whole chapter that includes a lot of information about how Obama, going forward, plans to use the military. And again, the Center for American Progress has their finger in the middle of that one. And then different types of diplomacy and part
well,
of
well, hang on a second. Let's stop on the military because that actually leads into my first question for you.
Okay.
They seem to have some rather unusual ideas based on what I'm reading in your book about what the military should be used for going forward. I'm going to let you share with my audience what that is, but I got to tell you, none of these things come to mind when I have thought of the military historically. So share some of those things with us.
Well, constitutionally, our military or our defense organization is to for no other purpose but to defend the United States and have a strong defense posture to keep others from attacking us. So here we go. Another Center for American Progress report, co-sponsored with the Institute for Policy Studies, which is the most left-leaning, pro-communist, progressive think tank, and it is tied to the progressives in the House of Representatives, the Progressive Democratic Caucus, Congressional Progressive Caucus, and it also has a connection to our current Secretary of Defense, Leon Panetta. Panetta used to be associated with IPS, and that's a scary thought all by itself.
Oh, yeah.
You can tell right away where he's coming from. And you'll need to go read the book, but we do talk about Panetta quite a bit in his different connections in the past. But right off the top, the plan is to cut $1 trillion over 10 years, $100 billion a year. Half of that is, quote, savings, which will be redirected to job creation. They do not spell out what kind of job creation there will be. They just say job creation. We get some hints further on in their plans.
Gee, my idea of savings would be you actually use it to pay down the debt.
Well, that's the second half. They say they're going to use it to reduce the deficit. Again, no details of how that will be accomplished. This is job savings. Created and saved because it is that specific. We don't really know what that's going to be. And by the way, we talk in the book of how that's just bogus. You can't count jobs saved because you have no way of knowing what that possibly could be.
Has any presidential administration ever used that term before? I don't think I've ever heard that until the Obama.
Now, we Google all of these different phrases and terms. We even Google whole sentences from reports or speeches to see if they have popped up elsewhere, which sometimes pays off and we find something. Oftentimes, though, it is a standalone phrase, so you know somebody in one of these think tanks or in the administration cooked it up, literally.
Mm-hmm.
Their plan now is to fight global warming, fight poverty, fight injustice, to turn our military into international peacekeepers. They don't want to be going into a defense posture anymore. They want to work with non-military conflict resolution and use our forces to do diplomacy.
Mm-hmm.
They want to cut our forces by 20%. They want to cut $21 billion from our nuclear arsenal. They want to cut $10 billion from research and development, which is how we come up with new weapons and perfecting our technology, because we have a technologically run military now. I used to work for the government almost 30 years ago. It's a long time ago, it seems, but I've worked in a division that it was all about using the technology for the military. So, you know, that's 30 years ago, and it gets more sophisticated all the time, but they want to cut money and stop doing this. They also want to or have a plan to cancel a Virginia class of submarines. Now, this is for covert operations, which means, in non-technical terms, spying on our enemies. These submarines, though, because they are clandestine, would also be used to transport special ops, perhaps for part of missions like getting bin Laden or whatever. And then they also want to cancel the Tomahawk missiles. They want no more missiles. In reality, the end game is they want our military to have no missile defense at all. They want to disarm the military. And this is spelled out in this report, the 2012 Unified Security Budget, 96 pages of this. They also want
to... I haven't read the report. Are they suggesting unilateral disarmament?
Of course.
Of course. Sure, why not?
They want to hand over military installations similar to after the Vietnam War, when we no longer were training a large ground force. They want to turn these locations into green incubators. Mm-hmm. In other words, to create more Celinda disasters. And that means the money's going to go along with it, too, because they're also including a green stimulus, using money from the defense budget. And it goes on and on and on.
The first stimulus worked so well, why not have a green stimulus on top of it?
Well, exactly. And for that matter, I just saw this morning and posted on my blog that the Romney campaign just came out, you know, and one of the punchlines is, if Obama's plans work so well, why aren't there any jobs? Why are people not working?
Let's talk about that for a second, because the book does a great job of pointing out, and I think most of my listeners know this, that unemployment is higher now than when Obama took over, but it does a good job of explaining that as we hear the Obama administration make claims of the jobless rate falling, that's really a matter of people falling out of the workforce.
Falling out of the workforce, and then there's a category, excuse me, I've been talking for days.
I'm sure.
I still have a voice.
Take
actually,
your
Aaron lost his yesterday during a taped interview, and he was just absolutely shocked.
Wow.
We were talking about the unemployment.
Yeah,
and
people falling out of the workforce.
Right. Well, there's a whole category of unemployed or actually never employed that are called the opportunity youth, and I talk about them in the chapter when we talk about the 21st Century Works Progress Administration. That was one of the chapters that I researched and wrote. And this opportunity youth group comes out of an Obama administration report. This is not something that a think tank came up with. This information came out of one of Obama's, I believe it was a CBO that drafted it up. There is something like, I'm going to round it off, 7 million opportunity youth. These are people who, kids that came out of high school or dropped out of college or are out of college, who for one reason or another never entered the workforce. They've never been employed. So we can't say that they are part of the unemployment statistics. People may not know that unemployment statistics are only based on the number of people who apply for new unemployment benefits and the people that are still weekly renewing those unemployment benefits. And then once those benefits have run their course, they drop off the rolls. So they are no longer counted on that end. But then we have this group of opportunity youth who were never in the workforce, who have never been counted. And I think that probably the CBO number is an underestimation of how many millions there are of them. So
when
our unemployment
I was going to say, when we talk about unemployment, it doesn't factor in, as you said, the people that have dropped out and given up looking for work and are no longer filing for benefits. It also doesn't count the number of people who are underemployed, taking jobs much lower than what they're used to, or maybe even having to take part-time jobs when what they really desire is a full-time job. So once you factor all of those things in, the nation really is in pretty dire straits right now from an economical standpoint and from a jobless standpoint.
I think that we probably exceed the worst of the Great Depression. They had numbers that they estimated there somewhere around between 25% and 35%. I think we probably rival that 25% for sure. I've seen various numbers, but I think for sure the 25% would be easy to meet, if not more so. And I love statistics that come out of the news that back up what we were writing about, because when you're doing current history, you're writing it as it's happening. It's very hard to keep up with what's happening. We now know, since we wrote the book, that the government has come out with a statistic. I went back and looked it up. The statistic is that Obamacare, once it is in place, will still leave 30 million uninsured. In August of 2008, there were 45.7 million uninsured, and Obama says, well, that's, you know, we're going to take care of all those people. We're not going to have anybody uninsured. Well, but we got 30 million still uninsured.
And the CBO, if I'm not mistaken, the CBO has come out and said that it's going to cost at least twice as much as they originally projected.
Well, not only that, I just looked at a statistic about what the cost is. For example, I went and looked up all the fine print after someone asked me yesterday for the more details. More than a third of the population, which is 100 million plus, people are on some kind of welfare. So the question comes, is that, what is that? Is that include Social Security, Medicare? What does that include? It does not include Social Security or Medicare. So on top of Social Security and Medicare, another one-third of the population is on some type of welfare. And the government has 80 different programs, which accounts for mostly food stamps and Medicaid. That's an increase of 34 million on Medicaid since 2000, and 17 million since 2000. 17 million were on food stamps in 2000. We now have 45 million as of 2011, and this includes citizens and non-citizens.
So let's review things for just a minute. We've got a deficit that's out of control. The price of gas, you know, has doubled. You take a look at the food stamp situation, and although people say it's a racist tag, he really is the food stamp president. And if I think the people who are making the accusation that it's a racist remark are the true racists, because there are people of all colors on food stamps. How does someone like that hang so close in the polls? I mean, in fact, leading Romney in many polls. I mean, what type of a country do we have? What type of an electorate do we have when they can't look at the deficit, look at unemployment, look at the price of gasoline, look at the number of people on food stamps, and realize that not only has Barack Obama not solved some of the economic problems we had at the end of the Bush administration, he's exacerbated them.
Well, there's a very easy answer here, and the very easy answer is 100 plus million receiving government handouts. More than a third of the population is receiving government handouts. The conservatives threaten that. They threaten to take that away. They're being told that their Medicare and Social Security are going to be taken away. So add those people to the pot, plus the 100 million, and then you take people who stir into the mix, people who are eligible or may well be on Obamacare, everything being free, food stamps free, health care free, all of this for doing nothing but sitting home and receiving your check in the mail. I mean, this is the plan. This has been the Cloward Piven socialist Marxist communist plan since 1965, when they, the husband and wife, Richard Cloward, the late Richard Cloward, and Francis Fox Piven first wrote their article published in The Nation, and people can go find that.
Now, they were at Columbia when Obama was there.
I believe so.
Okay.
But Cloward and Piven, they came up with this plan in 1965. They published this article. In Red Army, we go into this into great detail. They published this article on how to bring down or break the back of government. Going to Obamacare, I absolutely have always held the belief, and even more so now, Obamacare was never intended to work. It was intended at some point to implode, because just using these numbers, there's no way to support that. There's no, you don't have the taxpayer base. You don't, the United States has already had a lowering of its
credit
rating. Our borrowing power has already been dinged. It could happen again at any time. Where are the funds going to come from to support what Obamacare promises? Well, it can't. At the time that it implodes or self-destructs, there's going to be a hue and cry coming from the people saying, you've got to fix this. Government has got to step in and fix this. Then we get to where Obama has promised us to be. From way back when he was in the Illinois Senate, and that's single-payer health care, which means government-run health care. Not Obamacare, where the government is the overseer, but government-run health care. And then we become Canada and England, who have both seen the error of their ways and are trying to backtrack on that, because they've lost their doctors, they've lost their ability to take care of their people. So when other socialist countries are stepping back from government nationalized health care, we're running towards it quickly.
So you're saying with
Obamacare, it will break the bank.
The goal was to create a crisis and then, to borrow Rahm Emanuel's phrasing, then not let that crisis go to waste. And I think we all heard Glenn Beck when he was still on Fox. I have some issues with Glenn Beck right now, but I'll put those aside. He was right.
Yes, he was. He was right about a lot of things, but then on the other hand, he was using our research material to be right about a lot of things.
I said it on air. You know what? I was hoping you would. I was actually hoping you would, and I appreciate that kind of honesty on my show. But you know, his remarks that he was saying, that not only will you allow government to come in and take control, you will be begging them, and you know
exactly.
I guess everybody's had material stolen from them, so it's a big.
Yeah,
blow.
But you know, I used to get email. I've been blogging. I started blogging at the end of January 2008. And within a couple of weeks, Aaron and I met up online. We started swapping emails, and then we formed a collaboration that, you know, we've done three books and probably several hundred articles, because I do his article research and he does the writing. But this has been a very long-term thing. It's a very sore spot with me, because I've watched my work find its way everywhere without being given credit for it. I've even had things quoted verbatim and no attribution. So anyhow, that's not the mission. The mission here is to get the word out any way that we can. And, yes, Glenn Beck was right about a lot of things. I wish he had stayed on track and was still on air, because at least he repeated the information that a lot of us did. And that was powerful, because he had a platform and an audience that the rest of us don't. So that
Absolutely.
Was a very good thing.
And I may share my issue with him off air with you when we conclude the interview.
Oh, that'll be fine.
Yeah, I may not even go into it on the air. But at any rate, I can remember him giving those warnings way back when. And, you know, what people don't seem to add up, you know, when they look at the leftist mentality, is that there really isn't any intention for the people on government assistance to ever get off. And I've had a number of African American authors come on my show, Star Parker, C.L. Bryant. In fact, we've got Eric Rush on today. And they all say the same thing. I mean, this is just another form of slavery. And the actual chains have been replaced with a different type of bondage, and that's economic dependency. But the rules are still the same. And, you know, I think Star Parker wrote a book called Uncle Sam's Plantation. C.L. Bryant has a movie that just came out called Runaway Slave. We're going to try to have him on soon as well. And it's just obvious to me that there's never really any talk about getting people off of welfare, just getting them on. That's the whole plan, to get so many people in government assistance, rinse down the... And I don't know why the people out there can't look at that and say, well, they intend for us to always be here on welfare. You know, Republicans...
Because it becomes generational, though. That's the problem. It becomes generational. It becomes a way of life. And people don't see that there is any other possibility.
I guess that's a big part of it, and I'm not going to repeat the racist quote that LBJ said on the air, at least not verbatim, but he essentially said when he came out with his Great War on Poverty that he would have black people voting Democrat for the next 100 years. It wasn't, let's give black people a helping hand.
Right.
You know, it wasn't black people have been, were enslaved and then discriminated against, and now that they finally have equal rights, let's do what we can to help black people step up into society and have a higher standard of living. It's, hey, I've got an idea on how we can control their vote for the next 100 years. That's what it was all about from the beginning, controlling votes. And, you know, when you're brazen enough to even admit that, as LBJ was, and people still don't get it, I don't know what you can say to that. I would personally look at that and say, hey, this is a form of slavery. It's economic slavery. And, you know, I do want to break the bonds here. And unfortunately, not everyone sees it that way. And I guess your explanation of, the generational poverty and the generational dependency is the only, it's the best explanation I've heard. I can't think of any other reason.
Right, and then it goes beyond that. We write in about living wage and raising the minimum wage, but living wage is another way of enslaving people, in that the government will make a study and decide the value of someone's labor, and then employers will be told, well, this is what you've got to pay for this job, for this job description, this is what you have to pay, you can't pay less. And that was tried in Baltimore, and it worked so well that not only were companies driven out of Baltimore to relocate to friendlier territory, but the workers, the jobs, followed them out of Baltimore. And this has been tried in a lot of different cities. Baltimore is probably the poster child for the major failure. And the thing that is bizarre, after Baltimore failed, other cities tried to emulate it by saying, well, we can do it better. And the reality is it never works. You can't. This is a total control of the workforce. And then raising the minimum wage to a $10 minimum wage, which we keep hearing that one pop up. But if you're you have a small business and the cost of producing your product is $5, including labor and whatever, to produce a widget, you can't afford to be paying $10 minimum an hour. You're no longer going to be in business. And so that will drive small business completely out. We won't have anybody doing small business except maybe a mom and pop, and you live by, like our ancestors did, you live based on your needs. And then the other crazy part of living wage, a living wage to our ancestors was you earned enough money, sold enough of your produce or whatever to pay your mortgage or pay your rent, feed your family, clothing, the necessities of life, and then anything else was a luxury. Nobody even uses the word luxury anymore, because living wage now includes a flat screen TV, an iPod, an iPad, and whatever other toys and trinkets that you can think of. People now consider themselves in poverty and destitute if they don't have all the bells and whistles. And this is what progressives see as a living wage.
I understand completely. A story that I've told on the air before is that we had some sort of a partnership between our local city and a city in Russia that was of almost the exact same size. So both communities put together a little delegation and visited each other's city. And when the Russian delegation arrived here locally, I'm actually in the Bryan-College Station area right next to Texas A&M, and when they arrived here, one of the things that the local people wanted to do was to point out, you know, America isn't all milk and honey. So they took them into some of the impoverished areas of our community and said, we want you to see that, you know, this is the downside of capitalism. You know, we have our poorhouses too. And the Russians just laughed and said, these are the poorhouses. And I don't think people in America, when they talk about poverty, understand that in other countries, impoverished people don't have iPhones and large screen TVs and a nice car. You know, we have a whole different definition of poverty here. But as you said, we don't use the term luxury anymore because I think we've sort of convinced ourselves that we deserve everything.
Well, you know, once you have all of the bells and whistles, what is a luxury? A yacht? Well, most people don't ever expect to own a yacht or a Rolls Royce or whatever. Those luxury items are one on game shows. They're not things that the average person ever aspires to own, nor do they necessarily want it. I mean, we have millionaires that win the lottery, and they end up losing everything within a year because they spend like drunken sailors. But luxury is not something that people have to really attain to. I mean, we all have luxury compared to our parents, grandparents, and great-grandparents.
I think that's quite true, and I talk to my son about things like, you know, no color TV and no central heating and air and things like that, and he looks at me like I'm from Mars, you know. And I he's 21, and we look at these modern conveniences that we have, and I know the young people today, you know, the people like my son who are in their late teens, early 20s, they've known nothing but an extremely high-tech world with a lot of conveniences. And I don't remember the exact conversation, but just the other day I was, you know, explaining to my son what things were like whenever, you know, we were younger, and again, you know, had the air conditioning units on the window and the gas heaters in the winter, and he was kind of like, you're kidding me, right? And I said, no, that was it. And you go back a few generations before that, you had wood burning stoves and fireplaces, and you open the windows and you had screens for air conditioning, and it just, we don't realize how lucky we have it compared to other countries. I recall some group a while back complaining that the prisoners at Guantanamo Bay didn't have air conditioning in the summer. And I can't remember which public official said it, but he goes, I got some news for you. There are a lot of people in Cuba who don't have air conditioning. At any rate, we tend to take a lot of things for granted. So let me ask you this. There's an old saying, if you point out some problems but you don't have a solution, you're just whining. I know you're not whining, so I guess the solution is to vote Barack Obama out in November? Or is there a bigger solution?
Well, it's a very good start. Last week when I first started interviews, someone gave me an analogy that I really like. People need to see themselves on a steamship out at sea, and the ship is listing to nine o'clock to the left, and if it keeps going in the direction it's going, it's literally going to fall over, and it's going down. And Mitt Romney and Paul Ryan are not magicians. They're not going to be able to make everything like it was. They never can make everything like it was. But what we need to hope for is that they are going to set the ship right. We're going to be headed to 12 o'clock, so that we're at least on a steady course to fix things. And if they can get it to 1 or 2 o'clock, most people would be ecstatic. Barack Obama is going to take the ship down.
You know, one of the things we hear, and I think it was actually Pajama Media that put out a video the other day, is that so many people are concerned about a civil war. I mean, people are treating the Tea Party like they're terrorists. You know, even though the Tea Party, you know, I mean, I think you basically are, you know, all the Tea Parties are made up of saints compared to Occupy Wall Street. But at any rate, I mean, you hear stories about the government preparing to deal with Tea Party insurrections and so forth. I mean, where's all this coming from, Brenda? I mean, do you really think, based on all the research you've done, that we're headed towards some sort of a cataclysmic end if Obama's reelected? What are your thoughts?
Oh, if he's reelected, I don't know if I want to think about what possibly could come. there's, realistically, if he's reelected, the best hope is that Republicans control both houses of Congress and his powers are restricted, even all of these powers of the president that he can do end runs, because Congress could send, with both houses in control, they could send a lot of legislation his way. He could veto it, and they would override his veto. So he would be in a very tricky spot. They wouldn't necessarily be able to stop things he tried to do, but he would not have the power to stop them from what they could do. So if we should be stuck with him in the White House for four more years, we need a Congress controlled by the Republicans to counteract whatever he might try to do and to push through legislation and override his veto to neutralize him.
Well,
and then hope for 2016 that the Democrats are so thoroughly discredited that they all get thrown out.
Well, I can tell you this. I know a lot of Tea Partiers, and every single one of them adheres to the philosophy that you have to win at the voter box. I don't know a single Tea Partier that has a violent bone in their body and would ever do the types of things that the left seems to be speculating that the Tea Party
is projecting, but they're projecting what they would do.
Ah, well, that
the left is always projecting.
I just have to laugh at this when I hear that you know, the Department of Homeland Security considers the Tea Party to be a risk for domestic violence and domestic insurrection. I'm just like, where is this coming from? These are people who actually go out and vote. These are people who believe in the Constitution. These aren't people who, you know, stand on a bridge and wait to get arrested. I mean, we're talking about grandparents with their grandkids waving flags and singing patriotic songs. And it's just disgusting to me that the Tea Party gets labeled this way. Well, there are three books that we need to tell my listeners to go out and look for. The first, of course, is the most current one, which would be Fool Me Twice. And then, of course, there's Red Army. And then is it the Manchurian Candidate or President?
No, the Manchurian President.
President, okay.
Honestly, the three of those books together will tell you everything you want to know. And I'm a historian, so as a historian, I know in the future these three books are going to tell the story of Barack Obama and his administration and progressives
mm-hmm.
for a very long time. But that was not the purpose. Our purpose is always to get the word out. Amazon.com has all of them.
Mm-hmm.
I know that Barnes & Noble does online as well as in their stores. I just found out yesterday that Costco is selling Fool Me Twice. That was from an article complaining how Costco apparently likes conservative authors, but liberal authors not so much.
There's a reason for that. Conservative authors sell.
Yes. It's like conservative talk radio.
I tell you, I went into one of these massive book discount places. It was one of those deals that comes into a mall and sets up for 6 months and just has all these books that bombed at the traditional bookstores and bombed at Amazon. And, you know, they're selling, you know, five books for $2 or something crazy like that. And when I went to the political section of that, whatever you want to call this organization, every single book on that table, or I should say those tables, was a book written by a liberal. there was not one book by a conservative anywhere on those tables, which was, you know, I had gone there thinking, am I going to be able to get a deal on some conservative books? And I should have known better. There weren't any there. Talk radio, it's the same story. I mean, that's why you point this out in the book. They're talking about the fairness doctrine again. My thought is that there's a reason why conservative talk radio does much, much better than liberal talk radio, and that is what the liberals are talking about doesn't make any sense, and they can't back up their ideas. I mean, whether it's global warming or you name it, they really can't last long if they have people calling them up and challenging them on the radio. So, well, I assume that the books, again, you said, are available on Amazon. They are available wherever good books are sold. I want to thank you for being here today. It has been an absolute honor to have you on the show, and we look forward to having you back again sometime, Brenda.
Well, thank you.
You've been listening to the Tea Party Power Hour with Mark Gillard.